Bienvenidos a un nuevo episodio del podcast de K-Fan, un espacio en el que aprender de emprendedores que han creado, escalado y a veces vendido empresas tecnológicas.
Urbanitae es una nueva plataforma de inversión inmobiliaria que te permite invertir a lo grande con cantidades pequeñas. Uniendo a muchos inversores, logramos juntar el capital suficiente para aprovechar las mejores oportunidades del sector. Olvídate de complicaciones. Con Urbanitae ya puedes invertir en el sector inmobiliario como lo hacen los profesionales.
Good morning, everyone. How are you, Victoriano?
Pretty good. Here in sunny Madrid, for the people that are watching the video, they can see the sun in my face.
You're getting a tan. Victoriano has been on the podcast before. He's the co-founder and CEO of Graphex.com, which is actually a portfolio company of KFund One, our first seed fund. And today's guest is David Peterson, partner at Angular Ventures. We actually had his colleague Gil, I think, 3 or 4 episodes ago. So thanks for the time, David.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's great to be here, guys.
So to get into more personal stuff, before we get into more professional stuff, I was checking your LinkedIn page and I saw that you have a degree in government and history from Dartmouth. How does the one go from those two degrees to startups and then VC? Tell us a bit about your background.
Yeah, sure. It's funny. I mean, going back all the way to university days, I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I majored in the things that seemed most interesting at the time, which was, like reading lots of books and learning about history. And I love that stuff. So that's honestly, I was not optimizing the degrees that I got for some career path. You know, I was just trying to do whatever seemed interesting at the time.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York, but upstate New York. So kind of in like close to Albany, if anybody actually knows where that is.
In the Hudson Valley.
In the Hudson Valley, right in the Adirondacks. Yeah. So kind of somewhat in the middle of nowhere. But
I lived for 1 year in Tarrytown.
So. Oh, no way. Okay. Yeah. Just a few hours away. So grew up there, went to school in New Hampshire and then worked. I've worked at startups in Boston, New York, and San Francisco.
And why startups after school, after university?
Yeah, so I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do. Absolutely no idea. And
like most people out of college, I would
say. Yeah. And actually, it was 2010. And, all of my friends were going into classic, right, going into consulting and banking, because that's just like the easy thing to do. And I really didn't want to go into consulting. I actually applied just kind of the last minute. It was like April, right? And we're graduating in June. So it's really last minute here, coming down to the wire. I applied to Google. I just went to google.com/jobs and dropped my resume and applied and ended up getting an interview and went through the whole process. And they flew me out to Mountain View and got a job. That was my first foray into tech, basically. It was Google kind of picked my name out of a million resumes and then I was in.
And what did you do there?
Yeah, I was working on the advertising side of the business. So it was basically in sales. Slinging ads. Which was, I look back on it now, and that was maybe one of like the best possible first jobs I could have gotten, actually.
Why is that?
Like, for a few different reasons. So one is, at this time, Google, so there are a few reasons. One is that, I had to learn how to like sell, right? Day one, had to learn how to get on the phone and talk to people who were like 30 years older than me, and who were experts in their business. But I had to talk to them about advertising and sell them on advertising and everything. Right. And that was, I think the thing that you realize as you get older is that the more senior you get in any job, the more your job is just sales, right? Like that is the ultimate job, right? Is selling. And, but when you're 22, you don't realize that, right? Like when you're 22, you think of sales as almost being a dirty word. It's a used car salesman or something. And I think I realized way more quickly than my peers how fundamentally valuable sales was just by being forced into that from really early on. And the other thing is that, you know, I got to know so many different types of businesses because, you know, so many businesses leverage Google advertising, right, to grow. And so I just got to, you know, look, I was a government and history major. What the hell did I know about, you know, online businesses? But you get thrown into Google and all of a sudden you realize how many different types of businesses there are, how many business models are out there, and how they each are leveraging advertising to, you know, to grow in different ways. So it was a great way to just kind of understand how the world worked. And by the way, because I had google.com as my email address, like anybody answers your
That's
email,
powerful,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like I could meet with any CEO I wanted to, you know, in the companies that we were targeting and everything.
What
like
were
that.
The size of these companies usually?
It was all, so I was working exclusively with tech companies.
Okay.
And they were all, so like the, you know, at that time, the way we broke it out was based on volume of spend.
Mm-hmm.
So they were all spending north of $10 million a year.
Okay.
On Google. So they're relatively large. Like there were some, a lot of private companies, but some public companies too. And that's like, that's a crazy thing, right? I was 23 years old, 22, whatever it was, right? Like meeting with the VP of marketing and CRO of like a public company.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's ridiculous. But, you know, like you, so I learned a ton from that experience. And then it's funny because I remember I was at Google for just like 2.5 years. And then I was like, okay, this is way too big. Like I need to go to a small company like that. I'm done with that, you know? And I went to this small startup, right? Like basically the first employee. And all of a sudden, like nobody would respond to my emails, right? Like I had gotten so used to the google.com email, you know? And then all of a sudden, like people are just ignoring me all the time. And I was like, oh, okay. So now this is real sales, right? Like now you really have to figure out how to do it, right? Google was training wheels. This is the real world.
And you still feel that you're doing a lot of sales these days as a VC, like being on the other side of the table?
Yeah, of course. I mean, absolutely. What is this job if not sales? You know.
In what respects do you think it's very sales driven or sales heavy?
Well, look, I think that, you know, the reality is the absolute best entrepreneurs out there, the best founders out there are, you know, they have... they can work with like whatever investor they want, right? Capital is a commodity, you know? So a big part of what I feel like we need to do as investors is like, certainly we need to source, you know, we need to source deals. We need to be a magnet for interesting founders, right? That's a big part of it. And that's a quasi sales and marketing job. You know, we need to select, which is a select the founders we want to work with well, which is much more of kind of a, you know, in your own head, intellectual rigor, that type of job. And then we need to like help the companies, and helping the companies is often just another sales job, right? We are, you know, you're brought in to sell a new VP of engineering candidate on why this company is amazing, or you're brought in to, you know, whatever else, right? Like these are, it's amazing to me when you look around, it's amazing to me how many different parts of most jobs are actually just sales jobs.
Yeah. And on top of that, you have selling to the LPs all the time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, didn't even mention the most important people of all, right? The reason we're all here. Yeah, absolutely. Right. That's just one big sales job.
And so after Google, if I'm not mistaken, David, you went to a company called Comstack, and you were, I think on your LinkedIn, you had something like head of growth. And if I'm not mistaken, this was like 2013. So head of growth was it already a thing? Let's talk about growth a bit and what you were doing there.
Sure. Yeah. So that job, so Comstack is a really interesting company. They're a, you can think of them as almost like a marketplace, you know, with some SaaS on top. But they're focused on commercial real estate, and the marketplace is for data. So the data is specifically what's called lease comps. And the reason this data is very valuable, lease comps, by the way, that what that refers to is the terms of the commercial real estate leases, right? Those actual terms. Now, the reason this data is so valuable is because one, it's not public, right? Like sales are public. If a building is sold, right, that information is public. But all the leases in that building, those are never public. However, that information is super, super valuable because what, you know, let's say you're another, if you're a broker, it's really useful to understand what like the market is for office space in a particular building or a particular submarket or something like that.
And how do they get the information?
Yeah. So that's where the marketplace comes in. The way they get the information is it's like a give to get model. Right. It's like if you are a broker and you share your leases, then you can get credits and you can use those credits to get other people's. Right. That's the idea. So if you can kickstart this marketplace of sharing, then all of a sudden you have a pretty good sense of what the market is like. You know, you have a pretty good lease coverage. Once you have pretty good lease coverage, then what we did is we built this analytical platform on top of it and all of that data, and then sold that platform to developers, landlords, you know, REITs, like anybody who is basically hedge funds, right? Anybody who is investing in real estate. Because for them, you know, now this is, they can actually get an understanding of the overall market dynamics. So anyway, that was the
Obsessed lately with companies that are trying to get better market information, because I think they can really change the, like many different industries. The other day I was talking to the guys from Figures that Jaime actually introduced me to them, that they are doing something similar, but for salaries in startups. You get free information as well if you share your information from your salaries, from your company. And it's easy because they integrate with systems like Factorial and others. And it's super nice because when you're a founder, again, you need to make these decisions. Like, and it's always kind of complicated to figure out like what are the salaries benchmarks by asking other people. You know, and this information is really, really good. And I really like the model. Like you get information.
That's cool. That's great. I mean, I remember too, the, what is that company called? There's like a super old school consulting company that has benchmark information for salaries. It's like something with an R, but don't remember. I don't think that's it. I just remember that it was terrible. So maybe it's good. I can't remember the name so that I'm not, you know, dragging them through the mud, but it was so like the data quality was so bad. We use it at Airtable all the time to try to benchmark our salaries, and it was just useless. And like the need for exactly what you're describing is huge. It would be so valuable.
We've invested in some of these businesses where they get data and then build products on top, but we actually, our experience is that it's kind of tricky because you have to be really good at two things. You have to be very good at getting valuable data, and then you have to be very good at building valuable products on top of that data.
And a moat as well. You know?
And a moat as well. So get proprietary first-party data that no one else has. So as a team, and we've had several deals, in not in this space, like real estate particularly, but in general, I think as a team, you have to have both skills, like being good at data and getting valuable data, and then being good at building products on top of that data, which is easier said than done.
Transparent is one of these examples. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Look, it was definitely a challenging business to build. Thankfully, I think that the data, like this, truly nobody else actually had this data. So that was the valuable part, if we could get the data, right? Like people would, the analytical platform could be just a CSV export button and people would still buy it, you know, because the data was that valuable. But my job was basically to get the data. It was like, you know, so head of growth was, it was focused on that side of the business. And it was all about launching new markets because you can, if you think of it, it's like a marketplace within each, and real estate is a local business, right? So every city has its own little market that you need to launch. So it's a chicken or the egg problem each time.
And in the era of AI, I mean, this is going to become even more important, you know, having this access to this.
Absolutely.
Oh my God. That nowadays have, like when you can combine it with AI, it becomes super powerful.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I actually hadn't thought about that with CompStack. It's totally true. Yeah. I think they're well positioned because of that, as long as they can keep the data quality up.
Yeah. Nice. And if fast forward, David, I mean, how does the story with Airtable begin? Because you were one of the early employees there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I was obsessed with Airtable early. Like this was, so I left CompStack in 2015 or so, and I actually bootstrapped a company of my own for a few years before I went to MIT. And when I bootstrapped this company, the MVP of the product that I built was it was basically Airtable and Zapier, like duct taped together. I did it just one weekend. I was like, here's an idea. I think we can make this work. I'm going to build it this weekend. And if we can make money by the end of the day, Monday, then I'm going to do it. That dude, was like the,
no code before.
Dude,
no
this, it was right. It was, yeah, it was no code before anybody talked about no code. Right. Like, we actually, you know, the way we talked about it back in the day, I just remembered this as I'm talking to you guys. We talked about how it was a no stack startup. Like we had no tech stack was the idea, you know, anyway.
That's very cool.
Yeah. So I was obsessed with the product. I found it on either Product Hunt or Hacker News. Like I happened upon it and it was like the beta version. And I just like realized what I could do and how I could, you know, build this product with it. So I went for it. So I loved the product. I saw the vision. And then I actually went to, when I was at MIT, I worked at Founder Collective on the side, which is a you know, fantastic seed stage fund based in the States. They're on the East Coast in Cambridge and New York. So I was really lucky to work with those guys, you know, during school. And they had actually invested in Airtable's seed round. So like when I went to, you know, there's kind of two parts of the story. When I went to try to get the job, you know, they kind of a classic, like last round interview question. It's like, okay, look at the, you know, the portfolio. What are the companies you love? Like, what are the companies you don't like? Like, let's talk like investment theses, you know, mm-hmm. about these companies. And the company I like picked out was Airtable. I was like, look, like I love this company. Here's why, you know, I see the vision, whatever. And so then I worked with them for a year and a half and we came to the end of my time there and they were kind of asking what I wanted to do next. And I knew I didn't want to go into venture. I was like, I need to go. I had like seen what it was like, you know, for them over the past year and a half. And I was like, I need to go back to building. Like, I'm not ready for that side of the table just yet. So they asked me who they wanted to, you know, who I might want to work for, or whatever. And I said Airtable, like, of course, you know, I still love the company. And it's really funny looking back on it now because they kind of waved me off a little bit because at that time, you know, Airtable had been seeded 4 years before. So it had been a long time, you know, and it was still like 8 or 9 people, just the engineers. They were still just building products, you know? And I think at that point, a lot of early investors had been basically telling the team, guys, you need to verticalize, right? Like you're trying to do the horizontal thing. It's not like working. Yeah, exactly. Right. Like choose a use case, go after it. Like, what are you doing? And so I think that they, you know, a lot of the investors had just kind of lost faith a little bit. They were like, look, they're off in the wilderness. It's not going anywhere. You know, are you sure you want to talk to them? Like, why not talk to somebody else? Right. And I was like, look, I love the product. So like, I'm going for it, you know? So I was really lucky. They introduced me to the CEO and I kind of convinced him over the course of like 6 months that I could be useful.
The founders were Google engineers or something like that. I read somewhere.
So the CEO, Howie, he was he was a previous founder. He had founded this company called Etax, E-T-A-C-T-S, like Tacts. And that was a personal CRM, right? Like before personal CRMs were a thing. This was back in like
with a verticalized experience.
Exactly. So this is exactly it, right? So he went through YC in I think 2011 with Etax and he ended up selling it to Salesforce 9 months later. So didn't really have much of a experience, right? Startup journey with that. Yeah. He went to Salesforce and, you know, from what he told me, he was basically like kind of miserable. He was like a PM there and he was like, this is not interesting at all. And basically like landed in Salesforce and from day one was just trying to figure out what Airtable was going to be, right? Mm-hmm. Basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then he ended up working with, so the co-founder, Andrew, was a product manager from Google. So they went to undergrad together. That's how they knew each other. And then they brought in a third co-founder, Emmett, who was like the CTO, who had been at Stack Overflow, who's an early engineer at Stack Overflow. So that was the founding team, those three guys. It's actually, I mean, it's funny looking back on it because they shared in the early days, they shared like what their pitch deck was for the seed or pre-seed, whatever, the first round, you know, back in late 2012, early 2013. That pitch deck was the exact, like, it was exactly what Airtable became, right? Like they just laid out what they were going to do. And they were like, it's going to take a really long time. Mm-hmm. And then they raised enough money to do it. They kept burn incredibly low, right? Like cockroach mode, just worked in the mission and just built for 4 years, right? Like is basically the story. Yeah.
I think there are many companies like this, like Webflow also took like 10 years to build. Like, actually, I think the founders restarted the company three different times or something like that. Yeah. And also many investors lost faith in year three or four, right? When they didn't see any progress. Or Notion also.
Notion's the same.
Same story. Yeah. So you have many. Figma's the same story too. 6 years. Yeah. Yeah. I have to believe that Graphics is similar as well.
Graphics. That's going to be the fourth. We're going to name
exactly,
it. You know?
Exactly. Because at the end, this is the story of any horizontal platform that believes in this idea that, you know, you want to empower creative users, right? Like no coders, to do like many different things with very great building blocks that are kind of intuitive and all of that. And I really believe a lot on that. And it's not easy to find investors that believe in this type of solutions, you know, it takes time.
Totally. Yeah, no, it takes time. And I mean, look, I think that you're building it because to do it well, like think about Airtable or Figma even, right? Like you're building a new kind of paradigm of doing a certain type of work. Yeah. And you have to build all of the building blocks, like as you said, right? Like your words, right? You need to build these building blocks. Mm-hmm. And they also need to be, interoperable, right? They all need to work together. And they that needs to make sense from a product point of view. It needs to be elegantly done. And to do that well with a UI UX that the end users are going to understand well enough that they can actually build. Because ultimately that's what you're doing, right? You're building a product that people can then build with. Exactly. If they can't build with it, if you just have to do professional services to get them to use the product, you failed. It won't work, right? Because it needs, the only way it can be truly horizontal is if it can be bottoms up, everybody can onboard and they can all kind of build their own stuff together, right? We talked a lot about how the key with a product like Airtable is it needs to have a super low barrier, but an incredibly high ceiling, right? Like low barrier to entry.
Exactly.
Easy to get started, but like you, such a high ceiling that you can't really hit the edges. You know, you can just keep building with it, right?
Yeah.
It takes a long time to build something like that.
It is.
So it's actually, it's very on point with the graphic story because I think, I mean, we've been investors for many years now, and I think this is like two conversations that we've had with Victoriano numerous times about: are we going too fast? Are we going too slow? Do we need to verticalize? Can we continue to be horizontal? And I remember vividly at some point, Victoriano, I think, used specifically the story of Airtable to say, hey guys, be patient. It's going to take time. We're going to go horizontal. We need to build a great product and then things will go from there. Totally.
Exactly.
Yeah. And look, so all the power to you, man. It's the harder path, right? It is absolutely harder, but if you pull it off, The addressable market is every knowledge worker in the world, right? It's the biggest possible market.
And I think that the founders that, you know, start these type of companies, we are very convinced of what we're building because we are the first users, you know? I mean, I spent last year 300 hours or so using our own product. And I try like many similar products that are more vertical. And at the end, it's super clear to me is when I talk to other users, like, how can it be that nobody else is really trying to do the hardest part, that at the end will be the easier part, the easiest for the user to build this type of and solve this type of problems, you know?
Totally.
So David, you said you had been in, so you talked with the founders of Airtable for several weeks or months before joining. Is that what you were explaining?
Oh yeah. So, you know, Howie and I got introduced and we chatted a few times over the course of like 4 or 5 months, something like that, you know. And it was, it was partially me convincing him I could be useful and him convincing me that this was like a real company with a future. And, you know, there was no, cause there was no job listing or right. There was no like, you know, specific role that he was hiring for. But eventually I was able to kind of convince him that, that I could be useful. And I joined as the first growth person. And basically my, like my title was literally just the word growth. It was as generic as it possibly could be, right? He was very explicit. He was like, you're not head of anything. You're not the director of something or the VP of anything, right? Like, let's just grow some stuff because we need to figure out how to make this business work, right? So when I joined, I was kind of the, I was like his right-hand man. And we worked on everything growth related, you know? So in the, like that was as tactical as, like every Facebook campaign and AdWords campaign and experimenting on LinkedIn and Twitter, which has a terrible ad interface.
Yeah,
I don't know,
yes,
Victoriano, if you've played around with it, or like yes, whatever, right? Like long, long tail. We did a bunch of podcast advertising to like, we experimented with out of home. Like I bought hundreds of billboards and we played around with that, right? So did a bunch of stuff like that, but then also did, you know, our positioning and product marketing and like experimented with onboarding and figured out our pricing strategy. And, you know, it's just like every building block to building your go-to-market.
What worked best for Airtable at the beginning?
It's a good question. So, you know, like, look, the very early story was just really just inviting like friends and family and right, everybody, right? And just trying to get people to use it.
Word of mouth, yeah.
Yeah, it was pure word of mouth. I think like the secret with Airtable is that in the early days, Airtable was a, and you can see this, by the way, if you go back into like the Wayback Machine, right? The like archive.org. If you go look at what Airtable, the homepage looked like in 2016, you'll notice that it's super consumer because that's what bottoms up used to mean. Like it's hard to remember, but if you go back to 2015, 2016, and you'd think about, right, like who were the companies, if you were to think about who are the best bottoms up companies in the world, right, you would say like Dropbox. That's what you would say. And if you think about Dropbox, that's a consumer company. That's a consumer software business.
And save your own files.
Yeah, right. Like it was all about personal use cases and it was super easy to use, right? All you had to do was like drag a folder onto your desktop and you're done, right? It was very, very simple. And the whole, the playbook was get people to use it. They'll bring it to work. And when they bring it to work, we'll flip and turn that into an enterprise deal.
I remember Airtable had many templates for students.
Exactly. Yeah. So in the early days, that was like the idea was, okay, we're going to do the Dropbox thing, right? We'll be consumer. It's like kind of a prosumer app, right? We'll be consumer. And then people will bring it to work. They'll figure out use cases at work and we'll flip it, right?
That's how PLG works best, is when you are at the beginning oriented to prosumers, because at the end, that's how PLG works, right? Like you have people that are in love with your tool and they are selling within the company because they have been tried for themselves first, right?
Yeah. Well, I think what we realized is that the flip from personal use case to work use case just like wasn't happening, right? Like people would use Airtable for apartment hunting or to plan their hiking trip or whatever, all of which are templates you can find in the Airtable template gallery, right? People would use it for those things but they would never, like translate it to work. Yeah. They wouldn't bring it to work. So the secret of the early days at Airtable is that we were like super consumer. And then one day we were like, nope, we can't do this anymore. We're B2B now, right? Like we have to go after business use cases. We have to figure out how to do bottoms up within the enterprise from day one. Like it needs to be enterprise from day one. They can be individual use cases within an enterprise, but they can't be personal, like at home use cases, right? It just doesn't work. There's no money in it. Like it just won't work for us. And I think a big reason it didn't work was because Airtable is a complicated, deep technical product, right? Like Airtable is not like Dropbox. Dropbox is super easy to use. You just drag that folder, right? Whereas Airtable, similar to GraphX, right? Like you need to you need to really invest.
You need an architect, like thinking what is going to be 100%. Like the CRM of the company, what tables, how they're linked. It takes time. It has some.
Yeah, you need a builder, an architect. You need somebody who's going to really sink their teeth into it. Mm-hmm. You know, so in the early days, it was consumer. And then we realized, okay, we need to go B2B. And then the way that started was, or where we went from there was kind of identifying from the existing user base, okay, what are our best use cases that people have, that users have discovered? You know, they've discovered them. What are the best ones? And then
what were those, David?
So there were a handful. The first one that really like broke out was Airtable as a content calendar, which is, it's a funny thing looking back on it because like, you know, nobody at the company really knew what a content calendar was, right? Like, you know, we certainly didn't build Airtable to be a content calendar, but we just had a few people who were using Airtable as a content calendar and just loved it. And, you know, some of them, and these were at like big enterprises, you know, big media companies. These were places where like they could have used any content calendar, right? But they chose to use Airtable, or they even moved from content calendar specific software to Airtable, right? Like they were replacing, you know, something with Airtable. So that was enough of a sign that we were like, okay, there's something here. Like, why is this a good use case, you know? And then we kind of simultaneously built a bunch of campaigns and experimented with, hey, can we get more people to use Airtable as a content calendar? Can we just find more of these people? You know, so Google AdWords and Facebook and all that kind of stuff, just like paid, right? Just can we find these people? Just to validate our intuition that this was a good use case. Let's go find a bunch of people and see if they will buy it. And then also we started thinking about like, well, what is it that makes Airtable good at this? And can we use those? Can we come up with like a list of variables that matter? And then can we use those variables to try to like build a prioritization matrix of all the use cases in the world across all these different variables that matter? And can we rank them and try to find some additional use cases and then start to build go-to-market strategies for each individual use case? And that basically was like the growth team. It's like we just kind of organically became the team that did that.
Yeah, you took like ideas from your users, then trying to distill like what was the essence of why they were doing that, and trying to make a plan to scale that into more users.
Yeah. And like the goal was, okay, if we can find 3 to 5 use cases that are good, like land use cases, right? Like we can land in an organization with this use case, then we can expand. Because we know Airtable is a great horizontal product. And that's the real value of Airtable in my mind, is like, it's the, you can empower the, like a random person to build the perfect like solution for their work, that there is no vertical competitor, right? Because it's so unique to them, you know, but we need to land first. So we need to find these like pillar use cases that we can build a whole go-to-market machine around so that we can land in big organizations. That's how the strategy kind of
goes. And once you knew these use cases, what was the strategy for like reaching out more people for these use cases?
Yeah, I mean, it a little bit depended on the use case, because you know they were targeting different types of people, so they hang out in different places on the internet and that kind of thing. Yeah. You know, as an example, like so content calendar was. Like that sort of use case was, it was really easy to acquire users on, like on Google, things like that, because people search for that all the time. So like the search volume was really high.
Paid ads or SEO?
Both. Yeah. But because people are actually searching for it, right? We can harvest that volume, you know? But then there were other use cases where like people just don't search as much, but they're still super valuable. And they were good land use cases, but like community was way more important. So like an example was a ton of researchers, like user researchers, started using Airtable in the early days, basically as like a user research CRM / I don't know, like insight management system. I'm not really sure what you want to call it, right? Like it was, they were basically using spreadsheets before and they realized Airtable was kind of way better for this. And the reason we found out about this use case is because they have like user research symposia all the time and people are super open about the tools they use. And there was some presentation at some event and it was some user researcher showing off their use case. And they were like, you know, and then they shared they turned it into a template and shared it with everybody. And all of a sudden like
a community of early adopters, which is great.
Yeah, right. You're at that moment. Right, exactly. And we were like, oh man, I guess this is a thing. Like we had no idea, you know? So a lot of the early days, it was a lot of like listening to users, you know, like you think as the growth team that we would be, I don't know, experimenting with the product all the time or right, like doing that sort of thing. And basically we didn't do that ever, right? There was no product experimentation because, well, we had like 100 new users a day tops, right? What are you going to experiment with? You're never going to learn anything. It'll take you a year before you hit statistical significance on even the biggest change, you know? So we didn't experiment with the product for years. What we did is talk to users.
Like, that's a good insight. I mean, yeah. Like many founders are obsessed in the early days with very few users to do A/B testing that is not really useful at all.
Yeah. Waste of time. Absolutely. Yeah. I think, but look, the reason people want to experiment is because they don't trust their intuition. Mm. That's what it is, right? They don't want to trust that they know. Yeah. And so they offload that to an experiment so they don't have to decide.
I sell data analytics, so I trust all data, but you need to have enough data to make this analysis.
Right.
And it's all about the founder's intuitions. Yeah.
Yeah. If you talk to enough users, your intuition will be right.
Exactly.
But you just need to talk to them. You know?
Yes.
So like my first week, I think I had like 30 calls with users, you know, like that's what I just spent
time. And also that, you know, at the beginning, you need to talk to users because it's the best way to find these patterns, having these conversations, because you don't know what to measure if you don't have these conversations, right? Yeah. Like, so that's why it's important as well.
Yeah,
qualitative,
totally.
Yeah.
Were you monetizing yet at that point, David, or not at all?
So when I first joined, we were not monetizing. You know, we had active users, but we just hadn't turned on payment yet, basically. And we didn't really know what we were going to charge. That was the other thing, is we were unsure about that. We ended up, it's actually kind of funny because I get this question all the time about like pricing strategy and, you know, how much should we charge, whatever. And everybody thinks that, or everybody must imagine, I think looking at a company like Airtable, you're like, oh, you must've done a bunch of testing and experimentation to find the exact right price. And that like could not be further from the truth. Like basically, the pricing, we like looked at other SaaS applications that existed and we were like, okay, you know, Slack is like $4 per user per month. You know, like we looked at the ones, the big ones, right, that were bottoms up. We were like, well, I mean, we're way more useful than Slack. So we should be like at least 5 times more expensive. So we'll be $20 per user per month. Like that was it. Like, and it was more about it was like more of a psychological thing, right? We were like, we want this to be, we, it's not just that we are more valuable. We want people to like think that we're more valuable, right?
Yeah.
Like, and having a certain price level will force them to, right. It's very helpful. Sorry.
Pricing is always like you have an anchor, right? You compare always respect to other things.
Yeah.
And I did exactly the same research and the same reasoning with graphics.
Yeah.
And the way I saw it is that, look, if you're selling a SaaS that you're expecting every employee to use it, it's going to be in the range of $3 to $5 per month each, right? Like that's what I saw. Like every SaaS is positioning like that. If you are like a factorial and you expect every user to be in factorial or Slack or something like that, you will be in that price range, right? Once you are like more valuable and maybe it's going to be every single employee from every our department, right? Maybe then you are between 10 and 30 or something like that, right? And then if you're expecting to have 2 or 3 people from one department, maybe you are around 50, 100 or something like that, you know? And that's, I think that's pretty much like the reasoning that consumers do when they are evaluating the pricing these days of SaaS. And also that another thing that changed during the years that you were in Airtable, I would say, is that I would say that, you know, like now people are expecting to pay for many SaaS, for many solutions, even if they're solving a very similar problem. For instance, in graphics, we pay for Airtable and Notion, and, you know, for some use cases, they might be very similar, right? But at the same time, it's like, hey, Airtable has these features that are way better for this specific use case. Why not paying for Airtable for this specific use case while we still pay as well for Notion for these other things? Even if we could solve the same problem with only one solution. But I think that that's something that changed during these years, that people are paying, even a small startup like us is paying for dozens of B2B SaaS.
It's so true. It's such a different landscape than 2017, right? There's just been like such an explosion of SaaS products that you're every individual SaaS company is competing with now, right? Like you're not just competing with your vertical specific competitors or like use case competitors, right? Like you're just competing with like the SaaS budget in general. Exactly. You're competing with the fact that the CFO is probably like, hey, we need to cut 25%. I don't care where it comes from, but we need to cut it. Right. Yeah. I think that's a big challenge now. And I mean, I'm curious what you guys think about this too. I've thought about this in terms of specifically like SaaS that sells into like sales and marketing, or like mainly sales, right? Like the sales and like, you know, go to market tech stack. And the reason is because like I have a friend who's the, you know, VP of sales at a company that just raised their Series B, and he was like setting up the sales team. And he was walking me through like all the different things he was going to buy to set up the sales team. And it was like, I don't know, 11 or 12 different SaaS tools that he needed to buy. And like the fully loaded cost for each sales rep was like hundreds of dollars per month. It was like $300 or $400 per month. And it was just like so crazy, you know, like you could just look at that and you're like, this is something has to give here. Like there's just no way that this is the status quo and this will be steady state.
Yeah. And since you're talking about mentioning sales and marketing now, David, at what point did you guys move from thinking more about the pro user and the user and start thinking more about the company? Company and B2B, because before you were saying that you try to nail down like 3 to 5 use cases and then starting to think about B2B. How did you guys go about that?
So the reality is that once we started focusing on B2B, right, like we knew we needed to identify these land use cases that so we could get into companies. But the way we thought about each company was like we were layering on sales on top of bottoms up, you could say, right? We were doing that. We were layering on sales from day one, right? Like it was very clear that we needed to come at it from both directions. The way that looked at Airtable was we heavily invested in customer success. So we didn't have a huge team of sales folks like calling on everybody. Instead, we had a lot of customer success people who were really focused on, you know, empowering users at these enterprises who were using Airtable. So they were like a expand accelerant, you know, you could think. And then, you know, we had a handful of salespeople in the early days, just one sales guy, Sasha, whose job was basically to like, you know, whenever expansion had run its course and we'd gotten to a certain, like, you know, a certain level of expansion, a certain number of users, Sasha would swoop in and figure out how to like tie a bow around it and turn it into an enterprise deal. But customer success was working with companies before there was any enterprise deal, right? There was no MSA signed, right? There was no like, but customer success was in there, working with people, figuring out what the next use case was, right? Like kind of mapping the organization and pushing Airtable across the org. So that was our version of like bottoms up and top down. And then again, that was from like day zero. We were doing that.
Cool. And you mentioned before that you were in charge of not only growth, but partnerships. What were you guys doing in terms of partnerships?
Oh yeah. So, for us, there's a few different buckets of partnerships. So there's like, you know, pure technology partnerships, you know, and that's just, we're integrating with other tools. And in the early days, the most important was Zapier, actually. You know, that was like the first one we built. And it's the reason Airtable was able to grow as quickly as it did, was honestly because we didn't have the engineering resources to build those integrations ourselves. So
it became the main database for Zapier users, right?
Like, yeah, right. Exactly. I think it was mutually very beneficial, that exactly. integration, right? It was really useful.
Because Google Sheets, which is the other alternative, like is way worse for many use cases because I mean
it's not a database,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, totally. So Zapier was kind of the first and most important. And then, you know, we built integrations with, you know, Integromat, which is now Make, I think is what they're called now. And right, like a handful of other tools like that.
Zelonis.
Right. Yeah, right. So that's what technology partnerships looked like in the very early days. That changed over time. So eventually we built the surface area within the product where we could add on a bunch of more, you know, a bunch more technology integrations. Once we built out our own automations, for example, that became a surface area for technology partnerships. But for a long time, we didn't have that. So we didn't pay attention to tech partnerships at all, basically. Then there were, you know, another really important kind of bucket of partnerships was startup like partnerships. So we worked with VCs and accelerators and just got Airtable into the hands of startups like globally. And that was actually super valuable. You know, it was one of those, and I think there's a few reasons for that. You know, one was that Airtable is kind of this like, you know, Swiss Army knife type product, right? You can use it for so many different things. And if you get it into somebody's hands really early, when they have lots of different potential use cases, it can live up to its full potential. You know, it can just kind of be the Swiss Army knife for the founder or CEO. They'll start using it for a bunch of different things. Then as the company grows, it becomes like the default option, right? It's like whenever there's a new thing you need to build, people start, the first thing they do is they ask, can I do this in Airtable? And then they'll figure out they can't, and then they go do something else, right? And that's great, right? It's great for Airtable to be the default. And that works if you can kind of get in at the ground floor and expand, you know, wall to wall within these companies. Mm-hmm. So for startups, it was really useful. And it was, you know, getting in startups was useful too, because, you know, for two other reasons. Well, for one other reason, which is that startups are pretty, they're like aspirational, right? Like the person who works at kind of the boring tech company looks at the startup and is like, man, I would love if I actually worked at a startup. Like, what tools do startups use, you know? And then they see that they're on their screen, they're using Airtable, and they're like, wow, that's really cool. The people who use cutting edge tech use Airtable.
They're using Microsoft Access or something like that.
Right, exactly. And this is why actually, like, one of the things we did really early, and it seemed completely crazy at the time, is we invested a ton of money in really high quality swag. So like we gave away AirPods that had the Airtable logo on them and like a bunch of other things like this that were per packet, very expensive, but we were really targeted in who we gave them to. And like, we would give them to like the YC class, right? Mm. Like when the YC class was not 500 companies or whatever. This was 5 years ago. All right. It was a different time. But you know, like you give it to the YC class and you get 50 founders who are all like, you know, they're going all over the world, right? And they have Airtable AirPods in their ears. And that was actually, you know, we heard time and time again that people loved Airtable because of that and heard about Airtable because of that, right? Like, it's hard to track that stuff.
Yeah, but
it was really valuable. And the theory was all about this aspirational use. Right? Like, we wanted Airtable to be associated with that. And, you know, we did the same thing when Airtable started to be used by a lot of people in Hollywood, right, to manage like video production. And it was kind of a similar thing where we wanted, like, that's a very aspirational use case. And we wanted to really highlight that. So, and we would highlight the people that were doing that. So we did a lot of that stuff.
And do you have an enterprise sales team at that moment, or do they have now? I guess they have, right?
Yes, we definitely, like, Airtable definitely has one now. we didn't at that time, we basically just had, you know, a handful of sales folks who would do the, you know, swoop in later and turn a bunch of bottoms up usage that was driven by customer success, turn that into a deal. right? That was like the model for sales in the early days. Now, you know, Airtable's full on enterprise, right? And has a big sales team and is much more top down.
I would love to know how much of the revenue comes from enterprise than from the smaller company.
Yeah. You know, I don't have the latest numbers for you. And I probably, if I did, I probably shouldn't share them, but I don't have them anyway. So whatever I say here is not based in actual knowledge.
What's your intuition? You know?
Yeah, no, I think it's more than 50% at this point. It comes from enterprise.
Because I know Miro, for instance, which is also, you know.
Yeah, right, similar.
It's very similar in the sense that it's also a PLG and a lot of people, and it's very aspirational and all that. I would say, it's pretty high. I don't remember the exact number, but it's about 50%.
I think it's one of those things where it depends on how you define enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Because you can define it in a bunch of different ways to tell whatever story you want to tell. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, is it like true enterprise deals where like you have signed a contract, or is it just money that's coming from large companies? Mm-hmm. Right, so that's one potential way.
What I'm referring is that, you know, you go to Microsoft or one of these companies and you land a big contract of $500,000 or $1 million.
Right, so a true contract, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
The other way that this can get, the numbers can kind of be massaged is, and, you know, I saw this at Airtable, but you see this at a lot of other similar companies, is you'll start, you know, you bring in a proper sales team and they have targets that they need to hit all of a sudden. And they just start fishing, you know, in the user base. And they're basically talking to people who would have upgraded anyway, right? Mm. They were ready to upgrade, but they talk to them and they get them to sign a contract instead. And the question you need to ask from like a company management sales efficiency point of view is, you know, is that actually additive to our revenue or not? Right? Is that a good use of time by that sales rep or not? Mm. You know, because they were gonna, if they were going to upgrade anyway, you know, like what was the point, right? Yeah. So that's another. That's one of the challenges as well with talking about percent enterprise versus not. Yeah, yeah. You know, is like right. So anyway, I think that like Airtable is definitely going more enterprise and top down at this phase, but you know, that's
It gets so much easier when you are top of mind to do enterprise at the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, look, we tried to do top down selling from the very beginning. Like, it's not like we, you know, it's not like we didn't try to do that, because it would have been amazing to like go into Verizon and just convince them to sign some massive deal for every employee. Like, that would have been great, but it just didn't work, you know? And I think that's because, I think it's because it's a horizontal product and it has a ton of different use cases. And what are you exactly selling? Exactly. You know, you're not selling a particular solution.
Exactly.
You're selling the ability. You're selling the CIO of Verizon or whatever. You're selling to him or her. You're saying, hey, give this tool to your employees and they're going to go solve a bunch of problems for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. And all of these ideas are creating many different case studies with many different numbers. That's very difficult to sell top down, you know?
This was a classic thing. This is when I first, stopped believing. I don't know if this is when I first stopped believing, but this is when I was truly convinced that very often VCs add no value, right? It's this moment, which is after we close some round, an unnamed VC, I won't say who it was.
Hot take. Right?
Well, yeah, hot take, right? Exactly. And, you know, we closed some financing round. An unnamed VC basically said like, oh, like we're going to be so helpful. We're going to introduce you to a bunch of people, you know, a bunch of customers.
Customers, right?
Yeah, we're going to introduce you to a bunch of customers. And they introduced us to a very impressive list of like CIOs and CTOs and CEOs of all these massive companies, right? Like these were very impressive introductions. But all it did was it created like this insane fire drill for us internally, because we had to prepare for these meetings. And we kind of knew that these wouldn't go anywhere, because the CEO of some public company is not going to buy Airtable top down. We already knew that. And it just wasted like a solid month. of our time, like having these conversations. And then we just went back to figuring out what our bottoms up, top down combo sales motion was going to look like. And then we kept on going. Right? It was a complete waste of time. But anyway.
I have to say that now that you're a VC, it's really valuable that you have these learnings, because I mean, then you won't repeat the story with your
hopefully I won't force customer intros on my portfolio founders.
Exactly. Yeah. Just to show them how well connected you are.
Exactly. Yeah. That is exactly what it was. And you're like, wow, very impressive. But now this is really throwing a spanner in the works over here. Like, come on.
Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, at some point you moved from the US to London because of Airtable,
yeah.
Right?
So it's a funny story. It was basically, so my wife, she worked at Facebook at the time. And she had this opportunity basically to lead a big team in London. And it was like this amazing opportunity. We lived in San Francisco. To be honest, this is a topic for a whole other conversation. We did not love San Francisco. I just know it's not my cup of tea. So we were looking for a reason to leave anyway. And so I went to the CEO and I was like, look, like my wife has this great opportunity. I want to support her. Right. So I'm going to go. I'm really sorry. And he was like, kind of bummed, but he was also like, oh, fantastic. We need to figure out Europe. So, congratulations.
You've been promoted.
You've been promoted. You're the tip of the spear now. Go figure it out. So, I mean, it was kind of lucky, I guess, in that way. But so we ended up, so I came over a little over 3 years ago. To start figuring out EMEA for Airtable. And it was it was really interesting because, you know, we were not focused on Europe at all. Most of our salespeople were in San Francisco. So the time zones really don't overlap, right, in any real way. And
that's why people in the US need to move to New York.
Exactly.
Closer to Europe.
I 100% agree. That's why I love New York. Yes. Right, come on, best city because it's close to Europe,
and you're from there as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of interesting because we really weren't focused on the region at all. But at that time, like a sizable percentage of our enterprise revenue was coming from Europe, and we kind of didn't exactly know like why, right? Like we knew it was all this. There's a lot of internal expansion from existing customers, right? Like one customer, like a big multinational company, right? They have offices in the States and in Europe and it expands internally. So all of a sudden we have all this revenue that's like coming from Europe, even though it kind of started in the States, right? But so we kind of knew why it was happening, but it like kept on expanding. There was all this word of mouth and we were like, man, we need to get a handle on this. I came and just spent 6 or 8 weeks basically like gallivanting around Europe, meeting all of our customers and trying to figure out like what was the story, you know? Then COVID hit actually. So it was kind of the gallivanting stopped. And I had a flight booked for, I think it was like March 14th. I had a flight booked to go back to San Francisco to like present my findings and be like, here's what the plan should be. And I remember distinctly moving the flight like 2 weeks. Cause I was like, there's some weird stuff. So I was like chatting with the CRO and we were like, yeah, let's move it a few weeks, and then moved another few weeks and then canceled it. And
we actually never
flew back to San Francisco, never made it. I left Airtable before I could fly back.
And what was your thought process to move to VC? I think Gil told a bit that the story about how you two met, but what was going through your mind about, cause you said that when you were at Founder Collective, you thought you were not ready for VC or it was not the right time. Did you feel that it was the right time after meeting Gil and after their Airtable story?
Yeah. So, basically I knew that I wanted to leave Airtable because we were, I'd been there for a little over 4 years and we were kind of in this, we'd become like a pre-IPO company, you know, like the machine had been built and now we were just tweaking it and optimizing it. And I was excited to get back to early stage stuff. So I already knew that I was going to leave actually before Gil even mentioned the possibility of working together, right? Like he had no idea that I was going to leave, but I had already told, you know, the exec team that I was going to leave at that point. I thought that I would probably go back to an early stage startup. That's what I figured I would do. Like either join a team or start something like that. But when he kind of like planted the idea of venture in my head, I was like, oh, well, like, let me like consider this, you know? And the first thing I did actually was I chatted with a bunch of my friends who were founders in Europe, just to ask them about the venture ecosystem. And like, I mean, honestly, I was like, okay, what is the product that you're getting? You know, what's the quality of the product that you're getting? What's your NPS, you know, for venture in Europe right now? And what do you think is missing, you know? And I think that that's when I realized that I felt like my Airtable experience could actually be somewhat useful. I was like, this might actually be like, I'm very wary of venture in general, which is a funny thing to say as somebody who works in this business now. But, you know, I'm very aware of the fact that capital is just a commodity, you know? And so I wanted to be really sure if I was going to jump into this, that like there was some value that I could add, like some point of view I could have that was unique. So I really wanted to check that first. And it seemed to me like the Airtable experience was somewhat unique and it was valuable to some founders. And like my network is just different than a lot of folks over here. Cause I spent, you know, my whole career, you know, working in New York and SF at startups there. So it's not going to be useful for every single company, right? But for the right type of company, like then I might be able to be helpful in a unique way.
And you've been at Angular now for almost a year and a half, if I'm not mistaken. How's that been?
Yeah, that's right. Oh, it's been great. I've really, really enjoyed the transition. It's such a different job than working at a company. So that has been, that's interesting, you know, but I've really loved it. It's also been it's been a really interesting time to be in venture in general. Like I kind of feel lucky actually that I joined like as things were peaking and blowing up versus like if I had started 2 years prior, so that all of my experience had just been in like up and up and up bull market times. I think if I had started earlier, I think that might've messed with my head a little bit, because that's just not the way the world works.
Yeah.
Right? Like that was a crazy, you know, a crazy aberration. Whereas joining when I did, I feel like I have just had to be confronted with the reality of startups, which is from day one, which is that like raising money is hard. Raising follow-on money is hard. Startups are hard, right? None of this is meant to be easy, you know, and that's the reality, you know? I'm thankful that I started when I did, actually.
Has there been, David, any particular things that have surprised you on the positive side and on the negative side, in the sense that they were better than you expected and some others that were worse than you expected about being a VC or managing a venture capital firm?
Oh, interesting. I don't know. I think I went into it pretty eyes wide open. So I don't think there were that many surprises. Maybe what I'll say is, you know, I very explicitly chose to join a firm like Angular, which is small, you know, equal partnership, right? Like very early stage. I did that on purpose, you know, because I think that is like in my mind, that's the ideal way to do this business, right? You get to be, ultimately, I think of venture as being an artisanal business. Like it doesn't scale particularly well. And if you focus really early and you can write, you know, lead checks, then that enables you to do the two things that I think are most interesting and exciting about venture, which is you can make bets on really crazy stuff, right? You can invest in things that nobody else in the world believes in, right? Which is what we should be doing as VCs. Right? Like if I'm investing in something, if I'm investing in a company that has five other term sheets, what value exactly am I providing to the overall financial ecosystem? You know, nothing. And because we're able to, you know, write lead checks, it means very often we're the only people in the world that believe in this thing other than the founders themselves. Right. And that breeds a deep like intimacy with the founders. And that is the most, from my point of view, the most fulfilling and gratifying thing possible, right? Like that is what this is actually all about, is that we're betting on this idea together and we're doing this for the next decade. Like that's amazing. And, you know, I chatted with a lot of friends of mine who work at, you know, big multi-stage funds or so, you know, like the kind of classic like venture firms. And it's just the day to day, like it just feels so different. You know, it's just it's a very different job. It's much more political, and there's lots of things about it that I wasn't particularly excited about. So this version of venture, I feel like, is kind of the ideal for me, at least.
Super cool. David, last two questions of the podcast.
Yeah.
Can you recommend us a book or some kind of content? Can be startup related or not? And can you also suggest someone to invite to the podcast that hasn't been on yet?
Yeah, sure. So there is this book that I just started a few weeks ago called Money Games, which is, so I haven't finished yet. So I guess, I don't know, maybe it'll take a turn. But so far, it's amazing. I really, really recommend it. And it's basically the story of a private equity fund that took a Korean bank, took a national Korean bank private during the Asian financial crisis in the 90s. So that sounds like very niche and potentially very boring. I get it. But what's fascinating about the book is that it's written by the people who did the deal, right, at the private equity group. And so you actually learn about how the deal got started. You learn about every part of the negotiations. And it was written years and years after the deal was done. So you get to learn about how they got out of the deal, right? Like the whole entire life cycle. And that is just like, it's like a fascinating view into how this stuff actually works. So I would highly recommend it. I'm like surprised it's not on every list because I'm reading it and I'm just like, it's really.
What was the name again?
It's called Money Games.
Money Games.
Money Games says here, the inside story of how American dealmakers saved Korea's most iconic bank. Yeah, super interesting. Yeah. I think it's the first time ever that someone has recommended this, which is always good.
Oh, great. Okay, cool. Well, yeah, I highly recommend it. It's a really cool book. And in terms of, somebody who hasn't been on, I'm not sure of all the people who have been on, so that might be hard for me to recommend exactly. But, you know, I was just catching up with a great friend of mine, Ziv Reichert, who works at Local Globe. He's a new partner over there. We got breakfast the other day. We both have young, we both have baby girls at home, and we were, you know, commiserating about the challenges.
Like Jaime as well.
Yeah. I have a 2-year-old as well.
2-year-olds? Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah. So I have a 7-month-old. Ziv has a 2-month-old.
If you pay attention to the podcast, you could
hear it. Yeah.
In the background.
Exactly. He's a great friend and a fantastic investor and is also sleep deprived. So I feel like he'll be able to share some interesting bleary-eyed thoughts.
Super cool. We'll ask for an intro. David, thanks a ton. This has been super insightful. I think it's been a great conversation. Thanks a ton for your time.
Thanks for having me, guys. All right.